Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein, continued. Cassette 2, Side 1. If he is alive, it could be that there's nothing sinister about it. After all, public figures do use doubles. Perhaps in 2 or 3 weeks our friend Smith will be in shape to stand the strain of public appearance. Then they will trot him out. But I doubt it like hell.
Why?
Use your head. Douglas has already failed one attempt to squeeze out of Smith what he wants, but Douglas can't afford to fail, so I think he will bury Smith deeper than ever. And we will never see the true man from Mars.
Kill him?
Jill said slowly. Why be rough? Lock him in a private nursing home and never let him learn anything.
Oh, dear. Ben, what are we going to do?
Caxton scowled. They own the bat and ball and are making the rules, but I am going to walk in with a fair witness and a tough lawyer and demand to see Smith. Maybe I can drag it into the open.
I'll be right behind you.
Like mischief, you will. As you pointed out, it would ruin you professionally.
But you need me to identify him.
Face to face, I can tell a man who was raised by non-humans from an actor pretending to be such. But if anything goes wrong, you are my ace in the hole. A person who knows that they are pulling hanky-panky and has access to the inside of Bethesda Center. Honey, if you don't hear from me, you are on your own.
Ben, they wouldn't hurt you.
I'm fighting out of my weight, youngster.
Ben, I don't like this. Look, if you get in to see him, what are you going to do?
I'll ask him if he wants to leave the hospital. If he says yes, I'm going to invite him to come with me. In the presence of a fair witness, they won't dare stop him.
Then what? He does need medical attention, Ben. He's not able to take care of himself.
Caxton scowled again. I've been thinking of that. I can't nurse him. We could put him in my flat.
And I could nurse him. We'll do it, Ben.
Slow down. Douglas would pull some rabbit out of his hat and Smith would go back to Pokey. And so would both of us, maybe.
He wrinkled his brow.
I know one man who might get away with it.
Who?
Ever heard of Jubal Harshaw?
Huh? Who hasn't?
That's one of his advantages. Everybody knows who he is. It makes him hard to shove around. Being both a doctor of medicine and a lawyer, he is 3 times as hard to shove. But most important, he is so rugged and individualist that he would fight the whole Federation with just a pocket knife if it suited him. And that makes him 8 times as hard. I got acquainted with him during the disaffection trials. He is a friend I can count on. If I can get Smith out of Bethesda, I'll take him to Harshaw's place in the Poconos. And then just let those jerks try to grab him. Between my column and Harshaw's love for a fight, we'll give him a bad time. Chapter 7. Despite a late evening, Jill relieved his floor nurse 10 minutes early. She intended to obey Ben's order to stay out of his attempt to see the man from Mars, but she planned to be close by. Ben might need reinforcements. There were no guards in the corridor. Trays, medications, and 2 patients for surgery kept her busy for 2 hours. She had only time to check the door to Suite K-12. It was locked, as was the door to the sitting room. She considered sneaking in through the sitting room, now that the guards were gone, but had to postpone it. She was busy. Nevertheless, she kept close check on everyone who came onto her floor. Ben did not show up, and discreet questions asked of her assistant on the switchboard assured her that neither Ben nor anyone had gone into Suite K-12 while Jill was elsewhere. It puzzled her. Ben had not set a time, but he had intended to storm the Citadel early in the day. Presently, she just had to snoop. During a lull, she knocked at the door of the watchroom, stuck her head in, and pretended surprise.
Oh, good morning, Doctor. I thought Dr. Frame was in here.
The physician at the watch desk smiled as he looked her over. I haven't seen him, nurse. I'm Dr. Brush. Can I help? At the typical male reaction, Jill relaxed.
Nothing special. How is the man from Mars?
May? She smiled.
It's no secret to the staff, Doctor. Your patient?
She gestured at the inner door.
Huh?
He looked startled. Did they have him here?
Isn't he here now?
Not by 6 decimal places. Mrs. Rose Bankerson, Dr. Garner's patient. We brought her in early this morning.
Really? What happened to the man from Mars?
I haven't the faintest. Say, did I really just miss seeing Valentine Smith?
He was here yesterday.
Some people have all the luck. Look what I'm stuck with. He switched on the peeping Tom above his desk. Jill saw in it a waterbed. Floating in it was a tiny old woman.
What's her trouble? Nurse, if she didn't have money to burn, you might call it senile dementia. As it is, she is in for rest and a checkup. Jill made small talk, then pretended to see a call light. She went to her desk, dug out the night log. Yes, there it was. V.M. Smith, K-12, transfer. Below that was Rose S. Bankerson, Mrs., red K-12. Diet kitchen instructed by Dr. Garner, no orders, floor not responsible. Why had they moved Smith at night? To avoid outsiders, probably, but where had they taken him? Ordinarily, she would have called reception, but Ben's opinions, plus the phony broadcast, had made her jumpy. She decided to wait and see what she could pick up on the grapevine. But first, Jill went to the floor's public booth and called Ben. His office told her that Mr. Caxton had left town. She was startled, speechless. Then pulled herself together and left word for Ben to call. She called his home. He was not there. She recorded the same message. Ben Caxton had wasted no time. He retained James Oliver Cavendish. While any fair witness would do, the prestige of Cavendish was such that a lawyer was hardly necessary. The old gentleman had testified many times before the High Court, and it was said that the wills locked up in his head represented billions. Cavendish had received his training in total recall from the great Dr. Samuel Renshaw, and his hypnotic instruction as a fellow of the Rhine Foundation. His fee for a day was more than Ben made in a week, but Ben expected to charge it to the Post Syndicate. The best was none too good for this job. Caxton picked up the junior frisbee of Biddle Frisbee Frisbee Biddle and Reed. Then they called for witness Cavendish. The spare form of Mr. Cavendish, wrapped in the white cloak of his profession, reminded Ben of the Statue of Liberty, and was almost as conspicuous. Ben had explained to Mark Frisbee what he intended to try, and Frisbee had pointed out that he had no rights, before they called for Cavendish. Once in the fair witness's presence, they conformed to protocol and did not discuss what he might see and hear. The cab dropped them on Bethesda Center. They went down to the director's office. Ben handed in his card and asked to see the director. An imperious female asked if he had an appointment. Ben admitted that he had none.
Then your chance of seeing Dr. Bromer is very slight. Will you state your business?
Tell him, Caxton said loudly so that bystanders would hear, that Caxton of the Crow's Nest is here with a lawyer and a fair witness to interview Valentine Michael Smith, the man from Mars. She was startled, but recovered, and said frostily,
I shall inform him. Will you be seated, please?
Thanks, I'll wait here. Frisbee broke out a cigar. Cavendish waited with the calm patience of one who has seen all manner of good and evil. Caxton jittered. At last, the Snow Queen announced,
Mr. Berquist will see you.
Berquist? Gil Berquist?
I believe his name is Mr. Gilbert Berquist.
Caxton thought about it. Gil Berquist was one of Douglas's platoon of stooges, executive assistants. I don't want Berquist, I want the director. But Berquist was coming out, hand shoved out, greeter's grin on his face.
Benny Caxton, how are you, chum? Still peddling the same old hoax?
He glanced at the witness. Same old hoax. What are you doing here, Gil?
If I ever manage to get out of public service, I'm going to get me a column, too. Phone in 1,000 words of rumor and loaf the rest of the day. I envy you, Ben.
I said, what are you doing here, Gil? I want to see the director, then see the man from Mars. I didn't come here for your high-level brush-off.
Now, Ben, don't take that attitude. I'm here because Dr. Bromer has been driven frantic by the press, so the Secretary General sent me to take over the load.
Okay. I want to see Smith.
Ben, old boy, every reporter, special correspondent, feature writer, commentator, freelance, and sob sister wants that. Polly Peepers was here 20 minutes ago. She wanted to interview him on love life among the Martians.
Berquist threw up both hands. I want to see Smith. Do I or don't I?
Ben, let's go where we can talk over a drink. You can ask me anything.
I don't want to ask you anything. I want to see Smith. This is my attorney, Mark Frisbee. As was customary, Ben did not introduce the fair witness.
We've met, Berquist acknowledged. How's your father, Mark? Sinus is giving him fits.
About the same.
This foul climate. Come along, Ben. You too, Mark.
Hold it, said Caxton. I want to see Valentine Michael Smith. I'm representing the Post Syndicate and indirectly representing 200 million readers. Do I see him? If not, say so out loud and state your legal authority for refusing. Berquist sighed.
Mark, will you tell this keyhole historian that he can't burst into a sick man's bedroom? Smith made one appearance last night against his physician's advice. The man is entitled to peace and quiet and a chance to build up his strength.
There are rumors, Caxton stated, that the appearance last night was a fake. Berquist stopped smiling.
Frisbee, he said coldly, do you want to advise your client concerning slander?
Take it easy, Ben. I know the law on slander, Gil. But whom am I slandering, the man from Mars or somebody else? Name a name. I repeat, he went on, raising his voice, that I have heard that the man interviewed on 3D last night was not the man from Mars. I want to see him and ask him. The crowded reception hall was very quiet. Berquist glanced at the fair witness, then got his expression under control and said smilingly,
Ben, it's possible that you have talked yourself into an interview, as well as a lawsuit. Wait a moment.
He disappeared, came back fairly soon.
I arranged it, he said wearily, though you don't deserve it, Ben. Come along. Just you. Mark, I'm sorry, but we can't have a crowd. Smith is a sick man.
No, said Caxton.
Huh?
All three or none of us.
Ben, don't be silly. You're receiving a very special privilege. Tell you what, Mark can come and wait outside, but you don't need him.
Berquist nodded toward Cavendish. The witness seemed not to hear. Maybe not, but my column will state tonight that the administration refused to permit a fair witness to see the man from Mars. Berquist shrugged.
Come along. Ben, I hope that slander suit clobbers you.
They took the elevator out of deference to Cavendish's age, then rode a slide away past laboratories, therapy rooms, ward after ward. They were stopped by a guard who phoned ahead and were at last ushered into a physio data display room used for watching critically ill patients.
This is Dr. Tanner, Berquist announced. Doctor, Mr. Caxton and Mr. Frisbee.
He did not, of course, introduce Cavendish.
Tanner looked worried. Gentlemen, I must warn you of one thing. Don't do or say anything that might excite my patient. He is in an extremely neurotic condition and falls very easily into a state of pathological withdrawal. A trance, if you choose to call it that.
Epilepsy? Asked Ben.
A layman might mistake it for that. It is more like catalepsy.
Are you a specialist, doctor? Psychiatry?
Tanner glanced at Berquist.
Yes, he admitted.
Where did you do your advanced work?
Berquist said.
Ben, let's see the patient. You can quiz Dr. Tanner afterwards.
Okay. Tanner glanced over his dials, then flipped a switch and stared into a peeping Tom. He unlocked a door and led them into an adjoining bedroom, putting a finger to his lips. The room was gloomy.
We keep it semi-darkened because his eyes are not accustomed to our light levels, Tanner explained in a hushed voice.
He went to a hydraulic bed in the center of the room.
Mike, I've brought some friends to see you.
Caxton pressed closer. Floating, half concealed by the way his body sank into the plastic skin and covered to his armpits by a sheet, was a young man. He looked at them, but said nothing. His smooth, round face was expressionless. So far as Ben could tell, this was the man on stereo the night before. He had a sick feeling that little Jill had tossed him a live grenade, a slander suit that might bankrupt him.
You are Valentine Michael Smith?
Yes.
The man from Mars?
Yes.
You were on stereo last night?
The man did not answer. Tanner said,
I don't think he understands.
Mike, you remember what you did with Mr. Douglas last night?
The face looked petulant.
Bright lights. Hurt.
Yes, the lights hurt your eyes.
Mr. Douglas had you say hello to people.
The patient smiled slightly.
Long ride in chair.
Okay, agreed Caxton. I catch on. Mike, are they treating you all right?
Yes.
You don't have to stay here. Can you walk?
Tanner said hastily,
Now see here, Mr. Caxton.
Berquist put a hand on Tanner's arm.
I can walk a little tired.
I'll see that you have a wheelchair. Mike, if you don't want to stay here, I'll take you anywhere you want to go.
Tanner shook off Berquist's hand and said,
I can't have you interfering with my patient.
He's a free man, isn't he?
Caxton persisted.
Or is he a prisoner?
Berquist answered,
Of course he's free. Keep quiet, doctor. Let the fool dig his own grave.
Thanks, Gil. You heard him, Mike. You can go anywhere you like.
The patient glanced fearfully at Tanner.
No. No, no, no.
Okay, okay. Tanner snapped. Mr. Berquist, this has gone far enough.
All right, doctor.
Ben, that's enough. One more question.
Caxton thought hard, trying to think what he could squeeze out of it. Apparently, Jill had been wrong. Yet she had not been wrong, or so it seemed last night.
One more question,
Berquist begrudged. Thanks. Mike, last night Mr. Douglas asked you some questions.
The patient made no comment.
Let's see. He asked you what you thought of the girls here on Earth, didn't he?
The patient's face broke into a big smile.
Gee!
Yes, Mike. When and where did you see these girls? The smile vanished. The patient glanced at Tanner, then stiffened. His eyes rolled up and he drew himself into fetal position, knees up, head bent, arms across his chest. Tanner snapped, Get out of here! He moved quickly and felt the patient's wrist. Berquist said savagely,
That tears it! Caxton, will you get out, or shall I call the guards?
Oh, we're getting out, Caxton agreed.
All but Tanner left the room, and Berquist closed the door.
Just one point, Gil, Caxton insisted. You've got him boxed up. So just where did he see those girls?
Eh?
Don't be silly. He's seen lots of girls. Nurses, laboratory technicians, you know.
But I don't. I understood he had nothing but male nurses and that female visitors had been rigidly excluded.
Eh? Don't be preposterous.
Berquist looked annoyed.
Then suddenly grinned.
You saw a nurse with him on stereo last night.
Oh. So I did.
Caxton shut up. They did not discuss it until the three were in the air. Then Frisbee remarked,
Ben, I don't suppose the Secretary General will sue you. Still, if you have a source for that rumor, we had better perpetuate the evidence.
Forget him, Mark. He won't sue.
Ben glowered at the floor. How do we know that was the man from Mars?
Eh? Come off it, Ben.
How do we know? We saw a man about the right age in a hospital bed. We have Berquist's word for it, and Berquist got his start in politics issuing denials. We saw a stranger supposed to be a psychiatrist, and when I tried to find out where he had studied, I got euchred out. Mr. Cavendish, did you see anything that convinced you that this bloke was the man from Mars?
Cavendish answered, It is not my function to form opinions. I see, I hear. That is all.
Sorry.
Are you through with me in my professional capacity?
Huh? Oh, sure. Thanks, Mr. Cavendish.
Thank you, sir. An interesting assignment.
The old gentleman took off the cloak that set him apart from ordinary mortals. He relaxed, and his features mellowed.
If I'd been able to bring along a crew member of the Champion, Caxton persisted, I could have tied it down.
I must admit, remarked Cavendish, that I was surprised at one thing you did not do.
Huh? What did I miss?
Calluses.
Calluses?
Surely. A man's history can be read from his calluses. I once did a monograph on them for the Witness Quarterly. This young man from Mars, since he has never worn our sort of shoes, and has lived in gravity about one-third of ours, should display foot calluses consonant with his former environment.
Damn! Mr. Cavendish, why didn't you suggest it?
Sir,
the old man drew himself up and his nostrils dilated.
I am a fair witness, sir, not a participant.
Sorry.
Caxton frowned.
Let's go back. We'll look at his feet, or I'll bust the place down.
You will have to find another witness, in view of my indiscretion in discussing it.
Yes, there's that.
Caxton frowned.
Calm down, Ben, advised Frisbee. You're in deep enough. Personally, I'm convinced it was the man from Mars.
Caxton dropped them, then set the cab to hover while he thought. He had been in once, with a lawyer, with a fair witness. To demand to see the man from Mars a second time in one morning was unreasonable and would be refused. But he had not acquired a syndicated column through being balked. He intended to get in.
How?
Well, he knew where the putative man from Mars was kept.
Get in as an electrician?
Too obvious. He would never get as far as Dr. Tanner.
Was Tanner a doctor?
Medical men tended to shy away from hanky-panky, contrary to their code. Take that ship's surgeon, Nelson. He had washed his hands of the case simply because...
Wait a minute.
Dr. Nelson could tell whether that young fellow was the man from Mars without checking calluses or anything. Caxton tried to phone Dr. Nelson, relaying through his office since he did not know where Dr. Nelson was. Nor did Ben's assistant, Osbert Kilgallen, know, but the post-syndicate's file on important persons placed him in the New Mayflower. A few minutes later, Caxton was talking with him. Dr. Nelson had not seen the broadcast. Yes, he had heard about it. No, he had no reason to think it had been faked. Did Dr. Nelson know that an attempt had been made to coerce Smith into surrendering his rights under the Larkin decision? No, and he would not be interested if it were true. It was preposterous to talk about anyone owning Mars. Mars belonged to Martians. So? Let's propose a hypothetical question, Doctor. If someone were trying to... Dr. Nelson switched off. When Caxton tried to reconnect, a recorded voice stated, "The subscriber has suspended service temporarily. If you care to record..." Caxton made a foolish statement concerning Dr. Nelson's parentage. What he did next was much more foolish. He phoned the Executive Palace, demanded to speak to the Secretary General. In his years as a snooper, Caxton had learned that secrets could often be cracked by going to the top, and there making himself unbearably unpleasant. He knew that twisting the tiger's tail was dangerous. He understood the psychopathology of great power as thoroughly as Jill Boardman did not. But he relied on his position as a dealer in another sort of power, almost universally appeased. What he forgot was that, in phoning the palace from a taxicab, he was not doing so publicly. Caxton spoke with half a dozen underlings and became more aggressive with each one. He was so busy that he did not notice when his cab ceased to hover. When he did notice, it was too late. The cab refused to obey orders. Caxton realized bitterly that he had let himself be trapped by a means no hoodlum would fall for. His call had been traced, his cab identified, its robot pilot placed under orders of an overriding police frequency, and the cab was being used to fetch him in privately and with no fuss. He tried to call his lawyer. He was still trying when the taxicab landed inside a courtyard, and his signal was cut off by its walls. He tried to leave the cab, found that the door would not open, and was hardly surprised to discover that he was fast losing consciousness. Chapter 8. Jill told herself that Ben had gone off on another scent and had forgotten to let her know. But she did not believe it. Ben owed his success to meticulous attention to human details. He remembered birthdays and would rather have welched on a poker debt than have omitted a bread-and-butter note. No matter where he had gone, nor how urgently, he could have, would have, taken 2 minutes in the air to record a message to her. He must have left word. She called his office at her lunch break and spoke with Ben's researcher and office chief, Osbert Kilgallen. He insisted that Ben had left no message for her, nor had any come in since she had called.
Did he say when he would be back?
No, but we always have columns on the hook to fill in when one of these things comes up.
Well, where did he call you from? Or am I being snoopy?
Not at all, Miss Boardman. He did not call. It was a stat print, filed from Paoli Flat in Philadelphia.
Jill had to be satisfied with that.
She lunched in the nurse's dining room and picked at her food. It wasn't, she told herself, as if anything were wrong, or as if she were in love with the lunk.
Hey, Boardman, snap out of the fog.
Jill looked up to find Molly Wheelwright, the wing's dietitian, looking at her.
Sorry.
I said, since when does your floor put charity patients in luxury suites?
We don't.
Isn't K-12 on your floor?
K-12?
That's not charity. It's a rich old woman so wealthy that she can pay to have a doctor watch her breathe.
Humph. She must have come into money awfully suddenly. She's been in the NP ward of the geriatric sanctuary the past 17 months.
Some mistake.
Not mine. I don't allow mistakes in my kitchen. That tray is tricky. Fat-free diet and a long list of sensitivities plus concealed medication. Believe me, dear, a diet order can be as individual as a fingerprint.
Miss Wheelwright stood up.
Gotta run, chicks.
What was Molly sounding off about? A nurse asked.
Nothing. She's mixed up.
It occurred to Jill that she might locate the man from Mars by checking diet kitchens. She put the idea out of her mind. It would take days to visit them all. Bethesda Center had been a naval hospital back when wars were fought on oceans, and enormous even then. It had been transferred to health, education, and welfare and expanded. Now it belonged to the Federation and was a small city. But there was something odd about Mrs. Bankerson's case. The hospital accepted all classes of patients, private, charity, and government. Jill's floor usually had government patients, and its suites were for Federation senators or other high officials. It was unusual for a private patient to be on her floor. Mrs. Bankerson could be overflow, if the part of the center open to the fee-paying public had no suite available. Yes, probably that was it. She was too rushed after lunch to think about it, being busy with admissions. Shortly, she needed a powered bed. The routine would be to phone for one, but storage was in the basement, a quarter of a mile away, and Jill wanted it at once. She recalled having seen the powered bed which belonged to K-12 parked in the sitting room of that suite. She remembered telling those Marines not to sit on it. Apparently, it had been shoved there when the flotation bed had been installed. Probably it was still there. If so, she could get it at once. The sitting room door was locked, and she found that her pass key would not open it. Making a note to tell maintenance, she went to the watch room of the suite, intending to find out about the bed from the doctor watching Mrs. Bankerson. The physician was the one she had met before, Dr. Brush. He was not an intern nor a resident, but had been brought in for this patient, so he had said, by Dr. Garner. Brush looked up as she put her head in.
Miss Boardman, just the person I need.
Why didn't you ring? How's your patient?
She's all right, he answered, glancing at the peeping Tom. But I am not.
Trouble?
About 5 minutes worth. Nurse, could you spare me that much of your time and keep your mouth shut?
I suppose so. Let me use your phone and I'll tell my assistant where I am.
No, he said urgently. Just lock that door after I leave and don't open it until you hear me rap shaving a haircut. That's a good girl.
All right, sir, Jill said dubiously. Am I to do anything for your patient?
No, just sit and watch her in the screen. Don't disturb her.
Well, if anything happens, where will you be? In the doctor's lounge?
I'm going to the men's washroom down the corridor. Now shut up, please. This is urgent.
He left, and Jill locked the door. Then she looked at the patient through the viewer and ran her eye over the dials. The woman was asleep, and displays showed pulse strong and breathing even and normal. Jill wondered why a death watch was necessary. Then she decided to see if the bed was in the far room. While it was not according to Dr. Brush's instructions, she would not disturb his patient. She knew how to walk through a room without waking a patient, and she had decided years ago that what doctors did not know rarely hurt them. She opened the door quietly and went in. A glance assured her that Mrs. Bankerson was in the typical sleep of the senile. Walking noiselessly, she went to the sitting room. It was locked, but her pass key let her in. She saw that the powered bed was there. Then she saw that the room was occupied. Sitting in a chair with a picture book in his lap was the man from Mars. Smith looked up and gave her the beaming smile of a delighted baby. Jill felt dizzy. Valentine Smith? Here? He couldn't be. He had been transferred. The log showed it. Then ugly implications lined themselves up. The fake man from Mars on stereo. The old woman ready to die, but in the meantime covering the fact that there was another patient here. The door that would not open to her key, and a nightmare of the meat wagon wheeling out some night with a sheet concealing that it carried not one cadaver, but two. As this rushed through her mind, it carried fear, awareness of peril through having stumbled onto this secret. Smith got clumsily up from his chair, held out both hands, and said,
"Water, brother."
"Hello? How are you?"
"I am well. I am happy."
He added something in a strange, choking speech, corrected himself, and said carefully,
"You are here, my brother. You were away. Now you are here. I drink deep of you."
Jill felt herself helplessly split between emotions, one that melted her heart, and icy fear of being caught. Smith did not notice. Instead, he said,
See? I walk. I grow strong.
He took a few steps, then stopped, triumphant, breathless, and smiling. She forced herself to smile.
We are making progress, aren't we? You keep growing stronger. That's the spirit. But I must go. I just stopped to say hello.
His expression changed to distress.
Do not go.
Oh, I must.
He looked woebegone, then added with tragic certainty,
I have hurted you. I did not know.
Hurt me? Oh, no, not at all. But I must go. And quickly.
His face was without expression. He stated rather than asked,
Take me with you, my brother.
What? Oh, I can't. And I must go at once. Look, don't tell anyone I was here, please.
Not tell them my water brother was here?
Yes, don't tell anyone. I'll come back. You be a good boy and wait, and don't tell anyone.
Smith digested this,
looked serene.
I will wait. I will not tell.
Good.
Jill wondered how she could keep her promise. She realized now that the broken lock had not been broken, and her eye went to the corridor door and saw why she had not been able to get in. A hand bolt had been screwed to the door. As was always the case, bathroom doors and other doors that could be bolted were arranged to open also by pass key so the patients could not lock themselves in. Here the lock kept Smith in, and a bolt of the sort not permitted in hospitals kept out even those with pass keys. Jill opened the bolt.
You wait. I'll come back.
I shall waiting.
When she got back to the watchroom, she heard the tuck, tuck, to tuck, 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 tuck signal that Brush had said he would use. She hurried to let him in. He burst in, saying savagely, Where were you, nurse? I knocked 3 times. He glanced suspiciously at the inner door.
I saw your patient turn over, she lied quickly. I was arranging her collar pillow.
Damn it, I told you simply to sit at my desk. Jill knew suddenly that the man was frightened. She counterattacked.
Doctor,
she said coldly, your patient is not my responsibility, but since you entrusted her to me, I did what seemed necessary since you questioned it. Let's get the wing superintendent. Huh? No, no. Forget it.
No, sir. A patient that old can smother in a waterbed. Some nurses will take any blame from a doctor, but not me. Let's call the superintendent.
What?
Look, Miss Boardman, I popped off without thinking.
I apologize.
Very well, doctor,
Jill answered stiffly.
Is there anything more?
No, thank you. Thanks for standing by for me. Just, well, be sure not to mention it, will you?
I won't mention it.
You bet your sweet life I won't. But what do I do now?
Oh, I wish Ben were in town.
She went to her desk and pretended to look over papers. Finally, she remembered to phone for the powered bed she had been after. Then she sent her assistant on an errand and tried to think. Where was Ben? If he were in touch, she would take 10 minutes relief, call him, and shift the worry onto his broad shoulders. But Ben, damn him, was off skyoodling and letting her carry the ball. Or was he? A fret that had been burrowing in her subconscious finally surfaced. Ben would not have left town without letting her know the outcome of his attempt to see the man from Mars. As a fellow conspirator, it was her right, and Ben always played fair. She could hear in her head something he had said.
If anything goes wrong, you are my ace in the hole. Honey, if you don't hear from me, you are on your own.
She had not thought about it at the time, as she had not believed that anything could happen to Ben. Now she thought about it. There comes a time in the life of every human when he or she must decide to risk his life, his fortune, and his sacred honor on an outcome dubious. Jill Boardman encountered her challenge and accepted it at 3:47 that afternoon. The man from Mars sat down when Jill left. He did not pick up the picture book, but simply waited in a fashion which may be described as patient only because human language does not embrace Martian attitudes. He held still with quiet happiness because his brother had said that he would return. He was prepared to wait without moving, without doing anything, for several years. He had no clear idea how long it had been since he had shared water with this brother. Not only was this place curiously distorted in time and shape, with sequences of sights and sounds not yet grokked, but also the culture of his nest took a different grasp of time from that which is human.
The difference lay not in longer lifetimes, as counted in Earth years, but in basic attitude. It is later than you think, could not be expressed in Martian, nor could haste makes waste, though for a different reason. The first notion was inconceivable, while the latter was an unexpressed Martian basic, as unnecessary as telling a fish to bathe. But, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, was so Martian in mood that it could be translated more easily than 2 + 2 = 4, which was not a truism on Mars. Smith waited. Brush came in and looked at him. Smith did not move, and Brush went away. When Smith heard a key in the outer door, he recalled that he had heard this sound somewhat before the last visit of his water brother, so he shifted his metabolism in preparation, in case the sequence occurred again. He was astonished when the outer door opened and Jill slipped in, as he had not been aware that it was a door. But he grokked it at once and gave himself over to the joyful fullness which comes only in the presence of one's nestlings, one's water brothers, and, under certain circumstances, in the presence of the old ones. His joy was muted by awareness that his brother did not share it. He seemed more distressed than was possible, save in one about to discorporate because of shameful lack or failure. But Smith had learned that these creatures could endure emotions dreadful to contemplate and not die. His brother Mahmud underwent a spiritual agony 5 times daily, and not only did not die, but it urged the agony on him as a needful thing. His brother Captain Van Tromp suffered terrifying spasms unpredictably, any one of which should have, by Smith's standards, produced immediate discorporation to end the conflict. Yet that brother was still corporate, so far as he knew. So he ignored Jill's agitation. Jill handed him a bundle. "Here, put these on. Hurry." Smith accepted the bundle and waited. Jill looked at him and said, "Oh, dear. All right, get your clothes off. I'll help." She was forced to both undress and dress him. He was wearing hospital gown, bathrobe, and slippers, not because he wanted to, but because he had been told to. He could handle them by now, but not fast enough to suit Jill. She skinned him quickly. She being a nurse and he never having heard of the modesty taboo, nor would he have grasped it. They were not slowed by irrelevancies. He was delighted by false skins Jill drew over his legs. She gave him no time to cherish them, but taped the stockings to his thighs in lieu of garter belt. The nurse's uniform she dressed him in, she had borrowed from a larger woman on the excuse that a cousin needed one for a masquerade. Jill hooked a nurse's cape around his neck and reflected that it covered most sex differences. At least she hoped so. Shoes were difficult. They did not fit well, and Smith found walking in this gravity field an effort, even barefooted. But she got him covered and pinned a nurse's cap on his head. "Your hair isn't very long," she said anxiously. "But it is as long as some girls wear it, and will have to do." Smith did not answer, as he had not fully understood the remark. He tried to think his hair longer, but realized that it would take time. "Now," said Jill, "listen carefully. No matter what happens, don't say a word. Do you understand?"
"Don't talk."
"I will not talk. Just come with me. I'll hold your hand. If you know any prayers, pray."
"Pray?"
"Never mind. Just come along and don't talk." She opened the outer door, glanced outside, and led him into the corridor. Smith found the many strange configurations upsetting in the extreme. He was assaulted by images he could not bring into focus. He stumbled blindly along with eyes and senses almost disconnected to protect himself against chaos. She led him to the end of the corridor and stepped on a slideway leading crosswise. He stumbled and would have fallen if Jill had not caught him. A chambermaid looked at them, and Jill cursed under her breath, then was very careful in helping him off. They took an elevator to the roof, Jill being sure that she could never pilot him up a bounce tube. There they encountered a crisis, though Smith was not aware. He was undergoing the keen delight of sky. He had not seen sky since Mars. This sky was bright and colorful and joyful, a typical overcast Washington day. Jill was looking for a taxi. The roof was deserted, as she had hoped, since nurses going off duty when she did were already headed home, and afternoon visitors were gone. But the taxis were gone, too. She did not dare risk an Airbus. She was about to call a taxi when one headed in for a landing. She called to the roof attendant. "Jack, is that cab taken?"
"It's one I called for Dr. Phipps."
"Oh, dear. Jack, see how quick you can get me one, will you? This is my cousin Madge, works over in South Wing, and she has laryngitis and must get out of this wind." The attendant scratched his head.
Well, seeing it's you, Miss Boardman, you take this and I'll call another for Dr. Phipps.
Oh, Jack, you're a lamb. Madge, don't talk. I'll thank him. Her voice is gone. I'm going to bake it out with hot rum.
That ought to do it. Old-fashioned remedies are best, my mother used to say.
He reached into the cab and punched the combination for Jill's home from memory, then helped them in. Jill got in the way and covered up Smith's unfamiliarity with this ceremonial.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks loads.
The cab took off, and Jill took a deep breath.
You can talk now.
What should I say?
Huh? Whatever you like.
Smith thought this over. The scope of the invitation called for a worthy answer, suitable to brothers. He thought of several, discarded them because he could not translate, settled on one which conveyed, even in the strange, flat speech, some of the warm, growing closer brothers should enjoy.
Let our eggs share the same nest.
Jill looked startled.
Huh? What did you say?
Smith felt distressed at the failure to respond in kind, and interpreted it as failure on his own part. He realized miserably that time after time he brought agitation to these creatures when his purpose was to create oneness. He tried again, rearranging his sparse vocabulary to enfold the thought differently.
My nest is yours, and your nest is mine.
This time Jill smiled.
Why, how sweet. My dear, I'm not sure I understand you, but that is the nicest offer I've had in a long time.
She added,
but right now we are up to our ears in trouble, so let's wait, shall we?
Smith understood Jill hardly more than Jill understood him, but he caught his water brother's pleased mood and understood the suggestion to wait. Waiting he did without effort. He sat back, satisfied that all was well between himself and his brother, and enjoyed the scenery. It was the first he had seen, and on every side there was richness of new things to try to grok. It occurred to him that the apportation used at home did not permit this delightful viewing of what lay between. This almost led him to a comparison of Martian and human methods not favorable to the old ones, but his mind shied away from heresy. Jill kept quiet and tried to think. Suddenly she noticed that the cab was on the final leg toward her apartment house, and realized that home was the last place to go, it being the first place they would look once they figured out who had helped Smith to escape. While she knew nothing of police methods, she supposed that she must have left fingerprints in Smith's room, not to mention that people had seen them walk out. It was even possible, so she had heard, for a technician to read the tape in this cab's pilot and tell what trips it had made and where and when. She slapped the keys and cleared the instruction to go to her apartment house. The cab rose out of the lane and hovered. Where could she go? Where could she hide a grown man who was half idiot and could not even dress himself, and was the most sought-after person on the globe? Oh, if Ben were only here. Ben, where are you?